Welcome back, everybody. Today we're doing a deep dive into the very exacting world of medical-grade injection molding materials.
A world where even the tiniest decisions can really impact a final product.
Exactly, and that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Exactly.
So if you're out there designing devices or evaluating a product, or even if you're just curious about this whole process.
Or maybe you're just insanely curious.
That's right. Then you're in the right place.
Yeah. You're in for a treat today.
We're going to be covering a lot today. We're going to talk about sterilization and how that works with the materials.
So important.
Different mechanical properties like tensile strength and elasticity. We'll also, of course, talk about biocompatibility and how important that is.
Yeah, making sure that material is body friendly.
Absolutely. And then, of course, the fun stuff, regulations.
Everybody's favorite.
And cost considerations, because, you know, that always comes into play.
It always does.
And then also the growing importance of sustainability in this field.
It's a big one these days.
All right, so I'm going to jump right in. Are you ready?
Absolutely. Let's dive in.
Okay, so let's talk about sterilization. I mean, you can't really get around this in the medical world, right?
You can't. It's a must.
It's a must, but I think a lot of people don't realize how much that choice of sterilization method that you use can actually dictate what materials you can even use.
You're absolutely right, because it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of approach.
Mm.
Each different sterilization method like autoclaving or ethylene oxide gas sterilization or gamma radiation.
Right. Yeah.
They all have their quirks and they affect the materials in different ways. You can think about autoclaving. You're using high heat and pressure, which can warp or degrade some materials, especially certain types of plastics.
So it's really almost like you're choosing a cooking method, right? Like,
yeah.
You wouldn't bake a souffle with a blowtorch, would you?
That's a great analogy.
So have you run into any specific material challenges when you've been working with these different sterilization methods?
Oh, I have, many times. You know, you mentioned plastics, and I think that's a great place to start. Like, take polycarbonate, for example.
Right.
It's got great strength and clarity and impact resistance.
Yeah.
It makes it really popular for devices.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that.
But if you expose polycarbonate to gamma radiation for sterilization,
right,
you might see that it starts to yellow over time.
Oh, really?
And that's not ideal if you need, like, a crystal clear view, like, say, for a surgical instrument or something.
Yeah, those got to stay crystal clear.
They do.
So what do you do in that situation if gamma radiation is not an option?
Right. Well, that's when you really have to understand the nuances of the different materials.
Yeah.
And, you know, start thinking about alternatives and what might be a good fit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, polypropylene, for example, it's a great material for autoclaving.
Okay.
It handles that heat and pressure really well.
Mm-hmm.
But long-term exposure to radiation, not so much.
Mm.
So it's this constant balancing act that we're in as engineers.
Right.
Trying to figure out, okay, what's the best material? What are the properties we need? And how's it going to hold up to the sterilization method that we need to use?
So really, it's like material Tetris in a way, you know?
It really is.
Trying to make all the pieces fit.
That's a great way to put it.
Well, let's move on now to the mechanical properties of materials.
Okay.
Because obviously it's not enough to just have something that can be sterilized. You need to also think about how it's actually going to perform its job, especially inside the human body, right?
Absolutely.
So what are some of the key mechanical properties that you think about in this field?
It's a great question. And, you know, you're right. It's not just about strength. We also have to think about things like flexibility, elasticity, and fatigue resistance.
Yeah.
All these things play a role depending on what the device actually has to do.
Yeah, so you're not going to use the same material for a catheter as you would for like a bone plate or something.
Exactly right. So like you think about a catheter.
Right.
It needs to be flexible enough to navigate through blood vessels without causing any damage.
Mm.
So you'd look for materials with high elasticity in that case.
Right. And something like a bone plate, you need something that can withstand a lot of force.
Right. Lots of stress.
So how do you even begin to choose when you have all these different properties that you have to juggle?
Yeah. It really comes down to understanding what the application demands.
Mm.
You know, what are the specific requirements for this particular device?
Mm-hmm.
So let's take tensile strength as an example.
Okay.
That measures how much you can stretch a material before it breaks.
Uh-huh.
So titanium, for example, it's known for its strength.
Yeah.
It has a tensile strength of up to 1,000 megapascals.
Wow.
Compare that to stainless steel, around 600 megapascals, or PEEK, which is a high-performance polymer, at only about 90 megapascals.
Wow. So there's a huge range there.
Huge range.
And I imagine it's not just the material itself. It's also how you actually injection mold it, right?
Oh, absolutely. The injection molding process can impact the final strength of the part significantly.
Okay, how so?
Well, all of those factors, you think about mold design, injection pressure, cooling rate,
uh-huh.
they all influence how the polymer molecules are aligned inside the part,
uh-huh.
which directly affects the mechanical properties.
So it's almost like you need a PhD in both material science and the injection molding process itself to really get this right.
It helps, that's for sure. It's a complex field, but that's what makes it so fascinating.
Yeah, it's not just picking something off the shelf.
Right.
You got to think about how you're going to mold it and how those processing steps are going to impact how it actually performs.
Absolutely. And, uh-huh. you know, we talked about tensile strength, but we also need to think about elasticity.
Okay.
Which is that ability of the material to bend and return to its original shape.
I got you. So like those little springy doorstops that you see?
Yeah, the perfect example.
They can bend and bounce back thousands of times.
Exactly. And, you know, that's critical for devices like stents that have to expand inside a blood vessel.
Oh, right.
We need to make sure that they can handle those repeated cycles of expansion and contraction without fracturing or breaking.
Are there materials that are just kind of naturally more elastic than others?
There are, yeah, there are definitely some that are better suited for those kinds of applications.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, certain polymers are designed specifically for their flexibility and elasticity.
Okay.
You think about, like, the tubing that's used in intravenous lines.
Right.
It needs to be able to bend and flex without kinking or cracking.
Right. So it has to have that elasticity.
Exactly. And then there's fatigue resistance.
Okay. What is that?
So fatigue resistance is the ability of a material to withstand repeated cycles of stress without failing. So think of something like a heart valve.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Constantly opening and closing thousands of times a day.
Mm.
It needs to be incredibly fatigue resistant.
Yeah. That's a lot of wear and tear.
It is. And there are some real rock stars in this area. You know, materials that just excel at fatigue resistance.
Like what?
Well, cobalt chrome alloys are a great example. They're known for their exceptional fatigue strength.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes them a top choice for implants and devices that are going to experience a lot of cyclical stress, like a heart valve.
Wow. So we've got strength, we've got flexibility, fatigue resistance, and that's just the mechanical properties.
That's right.
But then there's this whole other layer.
A big one.
Biocompatibility.
Yeah.
How do we make sure that this material is going to play nice with the human body?
Right. That's where things get really interesting, because we're not just talking about the material being strong or flexible.
Uh-huh.
It needs to be compatible with the body's systems. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to make sure that it's not going to trigger an immune response or cause inflammation or release any harmful substances.
So it's not just about avoiding like a catastrophic failure, right?
Yeah.
It's making sure that it's not going to cause any subtle problems long term.
Exactly. Long term biocompatibility is crucial.
What are some things that can go wrong if you don't think about this carefully?
Well, the consequences can range from mild irritation to much more serious issues.
Mm.
You know, if material causes inflammation, for example,
mm-hmm.
that could lead to tissue damage, pain, delayed healing.
Right.
In some cases, it could even trigger an immune response that leads to implant rejection.
So you really have to know what you're doing.
You do. It's a critical part of the process.
How do you even test for biocompatibility? I'm imagining it's pretty involved.
It is. It's a rigorous process. It involves a whole series of tests.
Uh-huh.
And it starts with what we call in vitro tests.
Okay.
Where we expose cells to material in a lab setting.
Okay.
And we're looking for any signs of toxicity or cell death or changes in cell behavior.
So you're just looking for red flags, essentially.
Exactly. Any indication that there might be a problem.
And then what?
Well, then we move on to in vivo tests.
Okay.
Where the material is actually implanted in animals.
Oh, wow.
So we can observe how it interacts with living tissue.
That's pretty intense.
It is. It's not something we take lightly. You know, the well-being of the animals is always a top priority.
Right, of course.
But it's also essential to gather this data so we can make sure the material is safe for humans.
So you're really looking at every angle here.
We want to be as thorough as possible.
And it's not just about passing a test, right? You're really trying to understand the nuances of how this material is interacting with the body.
Absolutely. It's about understanding the whole picture.
Yeah. You got to think about surface properties, degradation rate, even the potential for chemicals to leach out over time.
Exactly. All those factors come into play.
So it's a constant process of learning and refining.
It is. The field is always evolving. We're always learning new things.
It's got to be exciting.
It is. It's what keeps you coming back every day.
Yeah. I can imagine, before we move on to the fun world of regulations.
Oh, boy.
I'm curious, are there any kind of cool developments in the world of biocompatible materials that have you particularly excited?
Oh, there are lots of exciting things happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one area that's really interesting is surface modifications.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, we can actually improve a material's biocompatibility by modifying its surface.
Uh-huh. How do you do that?
So, for instance, we can apply specific coatings that make the surface more cell-friendly.
Oh, wow.
So it encourages healthy cell growth and integration with the surrounding tissue.
So you're kind of giving the material a makeover to help it blend in.
That's a great way to put it.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And these coatings can also help to prevent things like blood clots or bacterial adhesion, which is really important for implants and devices that are used in cardiovascular procedures.
Wow. So you're really manipulating things at a microscopic level here.
We are. It's amazing what's possible these days.
Yeah, it really is. I'm getting a sense of just how complex and fascinating this field really is.
It is. There's always something new to learn.
It's not just about the material itself, right? It's about how you manipulate it, modify it to create something that's both functional and safe.
That's the goal.
But speaking of safety, I think it's time to address the elephant in the room.
Regulations.
Regulations, dun, dun, dun.
Everybody's favorite topic.
I know they can seem like a bit of a hurdle, but they're obviously there for a reason.
Oh, they are. They're crucial for ensuring that medical devices are safe and effective.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a huge impact on our material choices.
Okay. In what way?
Well, for example, regulations might dictate specific requirements for flammability.
Okay.
You know, we need to make sure that materials aren't going to easily catch fire in a sensitive medical environment.
Right. That makes sense.
Or they might set limits on the amount of certain chemicals that can be present in a material.
Uh-huh.
Especially if there are concerns about toxicity.
So you're really adding another layer of complexity to the decision-making process?
We are. It's not just about what performs well. It's about what meets those stringent safety standards.
And these regulations, they're not static, are they?
Oh, no. They're constantly evolving.
Right.
There are always new updates, revisions, interpretations to keep track of.
So it's a never-ending learning curve.
It is. You got to stay on your toes in this field.
But I imagine that those regulations can also sometimes drive innovation, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sometimes those hurdles force us to think outside the box and come up with even better solutions.
Okay, give me an example.
Well, you know, restrictions on the use of certain chemicals might lead to the development of new materials that are not only safer, but also more sustainable.
So it's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity.
Exactly. That's a great way to look at it.
Well, we've talked about sterilization, mechanical properties, biocompatibility regulations. Are we missing anything?
Let me think.
Oh, right. Cost. How does cost factor into all of this?
It's always a major consideration, especially in the medical device industry.
Right, of course.
You have to balance performance and safety with affordability.
Uh-huh.
And when it comes to injection molding, there are several factors that influence the overall cost.
What are some of the key drivers that we should be aware of?
Well, the price of the raw material itself is a big one, obviously.
Right.
So steel, for instance, is relatively inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
It's around 70 cents per kilogram.
Okay.
Aluminum is a bit pricier at about $1.50 per kilogram.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have something like titanium, which is a high-performance metal.
Right.
But it's significantly more expensive.
How much more?
Averaging around $15 per kilogram.
Wow. Okay, so you really get what you pay for.
You often do in this field.
But it's not just the raw material cost, is it?
No, it's not. You also have processing costs.
Right.
And those can play a big role.
Okay.
Some materials are just more difficult to work with than others.
Uh-huh.
They require specialized equipment or complex molding parameters.
Give me an example.
Okay. So if you're working with a material that has a high melting point, you're going to need more energy to heat it up, which adds to your energy costs.
Right.
Or if the material is very viscous, you might need a higher injection pressure.
Uh-huh.
And that can put more wear and tear on your equipment.
So it's like a chain reaction.
It is.
The properties of the material impact the processing cost, which ultimately impact the final price tag.
Exactly. And then you have to think about things like labor costs, which can vary a lot depending on location and the level of expertise required.
Okay.
And don't forget tooling costs.
What's that?
Well, the molds that are used for injection molding can be quite expensive, especially for complex parts with intricate geometries.
So there's a lot to think about just on the financial side of things.
There is. It's a big piece of the puzzle.
You know, it's not just about finding the perfect material.
Right.
It's about finding that material that really strikes the right balance.
Absolutely.
Between performance, safety, cost, and manufacturability.
You got it. It's a lot.
It is. But, you know, that's what makes it so challenging and rewarding.
That's the fun of it.
That's right.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground here, but there's one more thing we need to talk about, and that is sustainability.
Yes, very important.
It's becoming increasingly important in everything we do.
In every industry.
Absolutely. And medical devices are no exception.
No, they're not.
What are some of the trends that you're seeing towards using more sustainable materials in injection molding?
Well, one of the most promising trends I'm seeing is the rise of bioplastics.
What are those?
So bioplastics are plastics that are derived from renewable sources.
Okay.
Like cornstarch or sugarcane, rather than fossil fuels.
So you're kind of tapping into the power of nature. That's a great way to put it. We're trying to move away from those traditional petroleum-based plastics.
Uh-huh. What's the advantage of that?
Well, they offer a lower carbon footprint, and they can be biodegradable.
Oh, that's a big one.
It is a huge win for the environment.
Are there any downsides to using them?
Well, you know, like with anything, there are always trade-offs.
Uh-huh.
Some bioplastics just might not have the same strength or heat resistance as conventional plastics.
Okay.
So they might not be suitable for every application.
Right. So you got to be choosy.
You do. And, you know, another challenge is that some bioplastics require specific composting conditions to break down.
Oh, so it's not just a matter of tossing them in your backyard compost bin?
Not necessarily. It can be a bit more complicated than that.
Okay. So it's still early days for bioplastics.
It is. But the potential is definitely there.
It's exciting. What other trends are you seeing in sustainable materials?
Well, another trend that's gaining momentum is the use of recycled polymers.
What does that mean?
So this involves taking plastic waste and processing it into new materials that can be used for injection molding.
Oh, so you're giving that plastic a second life.
It helps to reduce our reliance on virgin materials.
Uh-huh.
And it keeps plastic out of landfills.
That's a win-win.
It is. It's a great way to close the loop.
Are there any challenges associated with using recycled polymers?
There can be. Yeah, the quality of recycled polymers can vary quite a bit.
Okay. Why is that?
Well, it depends on the source of the material and the recycling process itself.
Okay.
And sometimes the recycled material might not have the same color, consistency, or clarity as virgin material.
Hmm.
And yeah, that can be a concern for certain medical devices where aesthetics are important.
Right. You need things to look a certain way sometimes.
Exactly. So it's about choosing the right material for the right application.
Right. So choosing sustainable materials is a bit of a balancing act.
It is, but it's an important one.
Well, I think we've covered an incredible amount of ground in this first part of our deep dive.
We have. We've talked about sterilization.
Mechanical properties.
Biocompatibility regulations cost.
And sustainability.
It's a lot to consider.
It is, but I think our listeners now have a much better understanding of just how complex and how much goes into choosing materials for these medical devices.
I hope so. It's a fascinating field.
It really is so much more than meets the eye.
Absolutely.
We'll be back in just a moment to continue our deep dive.
Can't wait. And that's where things get really exciting.
Mm.
You know, researchers are developing these new materials with properties that were once considered science fiction.
Okay, now you've got me hooked. What kind of sci-fi materials are we talking about here?
Well, one category that's really intriguing is shape memory polymers.
Shape memory polymers.
Yeah, the polymers can be deformed into a temporary shape.
Uh-huh.
But when they're exposed to a specific stimulus, like heat or light, they remember their original shape and revert back to it.
So it's like they have a built-in reset button?
That's a great way to think about it.
That sounds amazing. What kind of applications could that have in the medical world?
Oh, the possibilities are pretty mind-blowing.
Give me an example.
Okay, imagine a stent that's compressed for easier insertion into a blood vessel.
Okay.
And then once it's in place, it's exposed to body heat and expands to its intended size.
Wow, that would make things so much easier.
It would, right, for both the surgeon and the patient.
Absolutely. Are shape memory polymers actually being used in medical devices yet?
They're still relatively new, but the research is moving really quickly.
Uh-huh.
We're already seeing them being explored for things like drug delivery systems.
Okay.
Where a polymer could release a medication in response to a specific trigger.
Oh, wow.
Or even in orthopedic implants.
Uh-huh.
Where a shape memory material could be used to create a more customized fit.
It's amazing to think about what could be possible.
It really is. It's a really exciting field.
But I imagine there are challenges too, right?
Oh, of course, with any new technology, there are always challenges.
Like what?
Well, one of the big ones with shape memory polymers is making sure that the trigger for that shape is something that we can safely and reliably control within the body.
Right. We don't want it changing shape unexpectedly.
Exactly. We need to make sure it's predictable and reliable.
So it's like, you need a fail-safe built-in just in case.
That's a good way to think about it.
Are there any other challenges that researchers face with these types of materials?
Well, like with any material that we use in the body, we have to make sure that these polymers are biocompatible
Right.
and that they don't degrade over time.
Right, we've talked about that.
And then there are the manufacturing challenges, creating these materials and processing them into intricate medical devices. That can be quite complex.
So it's pushing the boundaries of what's possible.
It is on multiple fronts.
Well, that's exciting. It's exciting to think about what the future holds.
It is. I think we're only at the beginning of this wave of innovation in medical materials.
Okay, so it's not just sheet memory polymers.
No, there are all sorts of other things happening.
It's like, what? Give me some more. What's getting you fired up these days?
Well, in tissue engineering, for example,
Okay.
researchers are using materials to actually create scaffolds that support the growth of new tissues and organs.
Whoa. So we're talking about creating materials that can help the body heal itself.
Yeah, that's the idea. It's like building a framework that the body can use to rebuild itself.
That's incredible. What kind of materials are they using for this?
All sorts of things, biodegradable polymers, ceramics, even metals. The key is to find a material that's biocompatible,
Right.
that has the right mechanical properties to support that tissue growth.
Okay.
And that will eventually degrade as the new tissue takes over.
So it's like a delicate dance between material science and biology.
It is. It's a really fascinating area of research.
It is. What about smart materials? What are those all about?
So smart materials are materials that can respond to changes in their environment,
Okay.
like changes in temperature, pH, or even the presence of specific molecules.
So it's like they can sense their surroundings.
That's a great way to put it.
That's wild.
Yeah. And in the medical world, we could use these smart materials to create drug delivery systems
Okay.
that release medication only when it's needed,
Right.
or implants that adjust their stiffness based on the forces they're subjected to.
Wow. So it's like giving the body a little extra help right when it needs it.
Exactly. That's the goal.
Are there any real-world examples of that yet?
Well, we're still in the early stages of development for a lot of these applications, but the potential is huge. Imagine a bandage that could release antibacterial agents only when it senses an infection,
Wow.
or a bone plate that could gradually become more flexible as the bone heals.
It sounds like the line between science fiction and reality is getting really blurry.
It is, and I think that's what makes this field so exciting.
It is, but it's also a little daunting, right?
It can be.
I mean, with all this advancement, we have to make sure that we're proceeding responsibly and ethically.
Absolutely. You're right. We need to think about the potential risks, the unintended consequences of these new materials, and make sure that we're using them for the benefit of humanity.
Right. It's easy to get caught up in the excitement of new discoveries and kind of lose sight of the bigger picture.
It is. We have to be mindful.
So I think these conversations are so important to have.
They are.
We need to ask the tough questions along the way.
I agree. Open dialogue and careful consideration are essential.
Well said. Well, before we get too philosophical here,
Right.
I want to bring it back to our listener and the practical challenges
Okay.
that they might face when it comes to choosing materials for a medical device.
Right.
I mean, we've talked about a lot, but I'm sure it can still feel pretty overwhelming.
It can be. If you're not immersed in this world every day, it's a lot to take in.
It is. What advice would you give to someone who's trying to make those decisions about materials?
Well, I'd say the most important thing is to do your research and ask a lot of questions. Don't be afraid to reach out to experts, consult with material suppliers, really dig into the
So
details.
be proactive.
Be proactive. Exactly. You can't just rely on what you stumble across online.
Right, you got to really dig in.
You do. And don't be afraid to challenge assumptions or ask for clarification if something doesn't make sense.
So be like an investigative journalist,
That's a great way to put it.
but for medical materials.
Exactly. You got to get to the bottom of things and make sure you're getting the full story.
What else would you recommend?
Well, I'd also say stay up to date on the latest industry trends and regulations. Things are constantly changing. You
Right.
don't want to be left behind.
So continuous learning is key.
It's a field that demands it.
Are there any resources or strategies that you recommend for staying informed?
There are lots of great resources out there.
Like what?
Well, attending industry conferences and webinars can be really valuable.
Okay.
It's a chance to hear from experts, see what new technologies are emerging, network with other people in the field.
Right. Build your network.
Exactly. And don't underestimate the power of professional organizations. A lot of organizations offer educational resources, training programs, mentorship opportunities.
So it's really about building that network of support.
It is,
Yeah.
and tapping into the collective wisdom of the industry.
Right, because you're not in this alone.
You're not. It takes a village.
Exactly. Choosing the right material for a medical device. It's rarely a solo endeavor.
It's a team effort.
What kind of team are we talking about?
Well, you've got designers, engineers, clinicians, even regulatory experts all working together.
Wow. So it's a really diverse group of people.
It is. And that diversity of perspectives is what makes the process so robust.
And it's an iterative process, right?
Absolutely. You might not get it right on the first try, and that's okay.
Okay.
It's about learning from your mistakes, adapting your approach, and continuously striving for improvement.
It's a journey, not a destination.
That's a great way to put it.
I think those are some fantastic takeaways for our listeners.
I hope so.
A lot to think about and explore.
A lot to digest.
It is. Well, before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave our listeners with a thought-provoking question to ponder.
Oh, I love a good challenge.
All right, are you ready?
Hit me with it.
Okay, here it is with all the incredible advancements we're seeing in material science.
Yeah.
What do you think is the biggest hurdle we need to overcome to make sure that these new materials are accessible and beneficial to everyone?
That's a great question. It really gets to the heart of why we do what we do, I think. I think one of the biggest hurdles is bridging that gap between innovation and accessibility. You know, we can develop all these amazing materials, but if they're only available to a select few, then we're not really fulfilling their true potential.
Right. It's like having a cure for a disease, but only making it available to those who can afford it.
Exactly.
It kind of defeats the purpose.
It does.
So what are some of the factors that contribute to that accessibility gap?
Well, cost is obviously a major factor. You know, developing and manufacturing these advanced materials can be really expensive, and that cost often gets passed on to the end user.
Right, but it's not just the materials themselves, is it?
No, it's not. It's also about the specialized equipment,
yeah,
the expertise, the regulatory hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
All those things contribute to the overall cost.
So it's like this whole ecosystem that drives up the price.
It really is.
So what can we do about it? How do we make these innovations more accessible?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right.
I think it requires a multifaceted approach.
Okay.
We need to find ways to streamline the manufacturing process, reduce production costs, and explore alternative funding models.
So it's not just about making the materials cheaper.
Right.
It's about making the whole process more efficient.
Exactly. We need to look at the big picture.
Are there any initiatives or strategies that you find particularly promising?
Well, one area that's showing a lot of promise is the development of open source platforms for material design and manufacturing.
What does that look like?
So these platforms allow researchers and companies to share their knowledge, their designs, even their production methods.
Okay.
And that can help to accelerate innovation and drive down those development costs.
So it's like a collaborative ecosystem.
Exactly. We're all in this together.
I love that idea. Are there any other approaches being explored?
Well, another strategy is to focus on developing materials and processes that are specifically tailored for low resource settings.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
So this might involve using locally sourced materials,
simplifying
production techniques,
or
even designing devices that are more durable and require less maintenance.
So it's like designing with those constraints in mind right from the start.
Exactly. It's about making sure the technology is appropriate and sustainable for the context in which it'll be used.
I love that idea. It's about meeting people where they are.
It is.
And finding solutions that really empower them.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we've covered an incredible amount of ground in this deep dive.
We have. It's been quite a journey.
It has. We went from sterilization and material properties all the way to shape memory polymers and tissue engineering.
And everything in between.
It's amazing how much goes into choosing the right materials.
It is. It's a complex but fascinating process.
Well, I think our listeners have a much deeper appreciation for it now.
I hope so.
Before we sign off, I want to thank you for sharing your expertise with us.
It's been my pleasure.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you learned something new, and we hope you'll join us again next time.